The following is a paid commercial program from the Ulster County Department of Health. This is the Healthy Ulster Radio Show, a weekly talk show exploring community health and sustainability with guests representing a broad spectrum of community partners working to make Ulster County the healthiest in New York State. This program is a community affairs presentation of the Emergency Department at Health Alliance Hospital in Kingston, a member of WMC Health.
Good morning and welcome to Healthy Ulster Radio. My name is Vincent Martello. I'm Director of Community Health Relations for the Ulster County Department of Health. Today, we're tackling a topic that affects millions but is often misunderstood and or overlooked, and that is digestive and liver health. And here to help us make sense of it all, we're joined by WMC Health's Dr. Raymond Kenny. Dr. Kenny is a leading gastroenterologist who specializes in everything from inflammatory bowel diseases to advanced endoscopy and cancer screenings. Dr. Kenny, welcome to Healthy Ulster Radio.
Thank you, Vincent. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you. So, Dr. Kenny, let's start with the basics. Can you tell us what gastroenterology is and a bit about your background and what drew you to practice in this specialty area?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Gastroenterology is the subspecialty of internal medicine, you know, an adult doctor who specializes in those diseases that affect the GI tract from the esophagus, stomach, colon. And it also includes, somewhat surprisingly to some people, liver and pancreas. So basically, when I talk to my kids, I tell them I'm a belly doctor. Anything in the belly, I tell them.
What are some of the illnesses or even preventative measures that you as a GI doctor treat? What are some of those typical things?
Well, the most common thing that everyone would be familiar with would be colon cancer screening, because everybody in the United States aged 45 to 75 should have had a colonoscopy. So that seems to be the thing that people most readily identify a gastroenterologist with. But yeah, anything in that abdomen, whether it's ulcers or liver disease, cirrhosis, pancreas, that's one of the things that drew me to it. It's so varied in its organs and presentations that it holds your interest.
So colonoscopy, really, as far as I know about it, is one of the few cancers that is likely to be prevented with proper screening. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. It's interesting in that it's the way I describe it. It's the difference between detection and protection. So for some cancers, such as breast cancer or prostate cancer, where we have a screening test, a mammogram or a PSA, we try to detect the cancer early. In colon cancer, we're trying to take advantage of the process, which starts out as a benign polyp. Some of those polyps, let's say 1 in 6, 1 in 8, takes about 5 or 8 years to grow up to become a cancer. So there's your window of opportunity. You got a benign thing that that exists for 5 to 8 years. If we go in there and take them out, harvest these polyps before they become cancers, in theory, you can prevent 80% of colon cancer. So therefore you can prevent 80% of the number two lethal cancer. The number one lethal cancer is lung, and for that you have to stop smoking. For colon cancer, you get your colonoscopy. So that's why everyone 45 to 75 should get a colonoscopy to harvest those polyps, to prevent the cancer from happening. So we're detecting it with the colonoscopy, but we're also protecting against a future event.
And what is it about a polyp that differentiates it from being benign and cancerous? I mean, is it inevitable that a benign polyp will develop into a cancerous one?
No, a minority of them would. We think over time, perhaps, it would be 1 in 8, 1 in 10 polyps of a particular type. Like a polyp just literally means bump. So it really means, what's important is what tissue makes up that bump. A polyp such as an adenomatous polyp or a sessile serrated polyp, those have a potential of becoming cancer. They're part of what we call neoplasm, that's growth. But there are polyps or bumps that are due to inflammation, and those polyps don't become anything. So even those ones that we consider precancerous, the majority don't become it. So it's a small minority of these polyps. But on the other hand, polyps are very common. About 50% of us make them. It's an uncommon event in a common disease, where it translates into your risk of getting colon cancer is about 1 in 22.
Yeah, a friend of mine recently got a colonoscopy, and she said, you know, and they found a couple of benign polyps, and she was all worried about it. And I said, don't be worried. That's exactly what's supposed to happen. You did exactly the right thing.
Exactly right. Yeah, you got to go in there and harvest them.
And
that's her ticket to come back and to be surveilled more often, because she had it. I mean, half of us make them, half of us don't. So all the colonoscopies you're doing on the people that don't have polyps really don't have a benefit. But to identify those people who have polyps and harvest them, that's a real benefit.
And what exactly is a Cologuard type of test? How does that colonoscopy is removing a polyp physically, but what about what's colonoscopy? Cologuard. Sorry.
Yeah, there are alternatives to colonoscopy for colon cancer screening, and one of the expressions I have is the best test for colon cancer screening is the one that gets done. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there are some people who are reluctant to undergo colonoscopy. If I talk to them and inform them of what the benefits are and how easy it is to do that, which takes time in a conversation, about 20% of people don't do it. They're not going to do it no matter what. So for them, you know, a non-invasive test like a Cologuard test is good because it gets something done. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, it's the difference between detection and protection. So a Cologuard test will detect a colon cancer if it's there about 92% of the time. Okay. So that's a fairly good test for finding cancer, but it doesn't do what we were talking about before. In theory, with the colonoscopy, by taking the polyps out, we can prevent 80% of it from happening. So the question is, do you want the test or do you want the disease? Okay. Mm-hmm. So so two different strategies.
So the colonoscopy is essentially doing both things at once, right? It's detecting and removing.
Right. And even with the Cologuard, the 92% is compared to the colonoscopy. The colonoscopy is the 100%.
Right.
So the colonoscopy is even better at detecting.
Got it. So let's move on to inflammatory bowel disease, which is, I guess, Crohn's and colitis are examples of that. Can you talk to us a little bit about what those are and how they manifest?
Sure. So colitis literally means inflammation of the colon. Anything in the body with itis on the end of it means inflammation. So colitis means that the colon is inflamed. Now the question is why? There's infectious colitis that you get from food poisoning, but in this particular case, when we're talking about the entity ulcerative colitis, it's a specific disease that the underlying cause actually isn't known. It's what we call idiopathic. So we don't know what caused, but the pattern is that it's recurrent and or persistent, as opposed to the one that you would get with a bacterial infection, which is self-limited. Presumably, this is autoimmune based, and it does run in families, but it's a persistent problem over time. It's got it's recurrent and it's a lifelong issue. Crohn's and ulcerative colitis are what I call them cousin diseases. They're related, and sometimes it's very difficult to distinguish one from the other. They have a lot of things in common, but consider them chronic inflammation of the bowel for reasons that medical science doesn't quite know. And in that situation, there's some things we do know about it. We have very good treatments now, much better than we had 30, 40 years ago. So it's a thing that requires maintaining and surveillance. Fortunately, it's a minority of the population that has. It's much less common.
And so what are the symptoms that people should not ignore if they notice something not right?
Certain populations, younger people tend to be the ones that are presenting with inflammatory bowel disease, and generally they're going to present with bleeding or diarrhea.
So what are the typical treatments?
It really depends on the severity of the disease. Okay. We use the mild or less toxic medications for mild disease and more aggressive, say, or potentially more toxic medications for the more serious disease. But nowadays, even now, we're getting medications that are both effective and not toxic. So there's an explosion now in different treatments for inflammatory bowel disease, which a lot of them are based on antibodies to things that are mediators of inflammation. And you'll see the commercials. They're the same types of things that would work on arthritis, psoriasis, all autoimmune diseases.
Uh-huh. And so are there lifestyle or diet or whatever measures that people can take by way of prevention or mitigation?
Well, as I said, we started out as medical science doesn't know the cause. All right. So without knowing the cause, it's very difficult to give definitive recommendations. But there are, you know, certain recommendations that when there's a flare or inflammation, you use a low residue diet. Your colon, you want it to rest theoretically. Like if you had a sprained ankle, you wouldn't get up and run on it. So you want to get the colon rest when it's inflamed. So generally we go to a low residue diet there. There is a lot of research being done on now the biome, the bacteria in your gut and its relationship to your body. And there certainly is going to be something in that that's going to be magical for this disease. I'm convinced that there's something in the biome that's causing this. It's our reaction to something in the biome. We haven't quite figured it all out yet. So that relates to your question about diet, because the diet does affect your biome. It's part of the bacteria that like to live there have a lot to do with the diet that you have. But we haven't worked out exactly what the best diet is for inflammatory bowel disease in the general sense.
Mm-hmm. And just for general gut health, probiotics, diet, they're all players in this.
I would think if you had a general recommendation, a Mediterranean diet's prudent. It certainly is very important for things like fatty liver and health in general. Americans generally have a calorie excess and too much carbohydrates and too much processed foods. So you would want to have a Mediterranean diet if you were looking for that. And most importantly, probably maintain a lean body mass. That's probably the single biggest health thing that you can do, particularly when you're talking about fatty liver disease.
Well, this is great, Dr. Kenny. And it's really an important topic and really an interesting one. And we want to learn a lot more, and including liver health. But first, we're going to take a very short break. You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. We'll be back after these words.
Westchester Medical Center Health Network's new Health Alliance Hospital is open in Kingston at 105 Mary's Avenue. The new hospital delivers on WMC Health's commitment to provide access to advanced healthcare right here in this community. Our comfortable and welcoming new Health Alliance Hospital has highly skilled doctors, nurses, and staff. We are ready to make your healthcare experience the best it can be. Here are just a few of the services ready to take care of you and your loved ones when you need us. A new emergency department with 24/7 triage for behavioral health needs, life-saving advanced cardiology programs, family birth center, private rooms, precise imaging technology, critical care support. And later this year, our inpatient psychiatry program will be reestablished to complement existing emergency and outpatient programs. Go to hahv.org for information. That's hahv.org.
I never realized that I'd be taking care of a 2-year-old and a 9-year-old on my own. I think men can be a little stubborn sometimes, where pride gets in the way and they may want the help, they may not know how to ask. With my traditions, with the family support in line, and just with my mind frame, I was able to turn a negative into a positive. I knew I needed more tools in my toolbox to take care of these little girls that had just lost their mother. It's time for me to be that father that I knew I could be. I think just being that good role model as well, that models good behavior in front of them, going to work every day, coming home and being able to put on that smile. The biggest reward about being a dad is sitting back and watching your kids be happy.
Never stop being a dad. That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Here's the deal. We gotta set ourselves up. See, retirement is the long game. We gotta make moves and make them early. Set up goals. Don't worry about a setback. Just save up and stack up to reach them. Let's put ourselves in the right position. Pre-game to greater things.
Start building your retirement plan at thisispretirement.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
And now, Healthy Ulster continues. This is a weekly presentation of the Ulster County Department of Health on 92.9 WBPM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. And today we're talking with Dr. Kenny, Raymond Kenny, who's a leading gastroenterologist. And we're talking about various diseases that can infect the GI tract. We're talking about preventative measures to have a healthy gut. And we also want to talk about liver health, which Dr. Kenny also an area that he also works in. So Dr. Kenny, liver disease is another area where people don't often realize that there's an issue until it's serious. What are some of the early signs of an abnormal condition that people might miss?
Well, unfortunately, it's commonly missed, and commonly missed for years, because you don't really have much in the way of signs and symptoms early on. And in fact, most people would think it's most often seen in your blood work. And actually, that's when people are identified. A simple liver panel, an elevated AST, ALT on your blood work, an elevated enzyme is an indication of a problem with the liver. But you can even have normal liver enzymes and still have a significant liver disease. So it's not uncommon to have that. So the most common liver disease in the United States now is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is now called metabolic dysfunction associated steatohepatitis, a long word. Okay. But basically, it's due to too many calories in your body. The body takes those calories, turns it into triglycerides, you stores it in fat in your liver. And in some people, that's toxic to the liver. When I give this lecture to people, I say, look to your left, look to the right. There's the person on each side. One of the three of you has fatty liver. So it's that common in the United States, fatty liver. But there's a subset of those people with the fatty liver that actually have inflammation going on. And then part of the discussion is, the person looks to the left and right, I say, I know, you're picking on that fat guy. Well, you know, that is true. It is associated with obesity. But 10% of people with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease are thin, have a normal body habitus. And that's, we call them, you know, skinny NAFLD, if you will. But 90% of them are overweight. And the more overweight you get, the more likely it is. If you have a BMI of 40, morbidly obese, it's 95% certain you have fatty liver. And of that very common disease, let's say it's 10, 15% of them have a progressive inflammation that will lead to cirrhosis. So the most common cause of cirrhosis in the United States is not alcohol. It's not that you're an alcoholic, you're a carboholic. You're taking too many carbs, you're getting big, you're getting diabetes, hypertension. It leads to this whole cluster of things, which we call the metabolic syndrome, hypertension, diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. It's also linked to reflux disease and cancer. For all of those reasons that when we were talking earlier about diet, Mediterranean diet and maintaining a lean body mass are probably the most important things for GI health.
And what exactly is sclerosis of the liver?
Cirrhosis is scarring. It's a stage of scarring. Like if you cut yourself, the tissue that's replaced is not normal tissue. It's scar tissue. Well, that process goes on in the body throughout where there's damage, repair. In the liver, when that happens, there starts to be strands of fibrosis or scarring going across the liver. And we grade it. One, two, three, four. And the fourth stage or the worst stage is cirrhosis. And you can actually have cirrhosis for 10 years before you start having symptoms. So that's when people say, well, somebody's jaundiced or they develop fluid in the belly. Well, that person probably had cirrhosis for the past decade and didn't know it.
And do the typical blood tests that we all get, you know, during our annual physical with our primary care physician, do those tests pick up early markers, or is that a routine thing?
They would show in a good majority of people, but there's a sizable minority that they don't. And the other thing is that the standard for those things has shifted over time. We historically did lab tests by having 100 people walk in the door who said they were normal, and we did the blood test on them, and we took them as the standard. Okay, well, the problem with that is that over time, Americans have gotten fatter and gotten bigger. So the test that we're talking about is the ALT. So the upper limit of the ALT used to be 31. But then it's, as the Americans fattened, the 100 people go in there, the ALT rose. So that the upper limit of normal grew to be 77 until all of a sudden the GI community decided that 77, while it might be normal for the 100 guys who walk in the store, they're not healthy. So we then changed that standard to what is physiologically normal and healthy, brought it back down to 31. And now it's more likely that that test will be abnormal. And that's important because those normal ranges, they don't turn up red on the panel. So people don't notice that they're abnormal. Like your primary doc isn't going to notice that. It's in the range of normal because we've defined it that way. That's why there's a whole movement to change back to what it was. So now with that change, you're seeing it a little bit more often, but it still can slip through. There are people who have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease who have normal liver enzymes. But you're right. That's the first best screen. Is a simple liver pattern. And if it's an ALT is greater than 31 in a male, or technically 20 in a female, I would look at that sideways. The panel may say that it's normal up to 45, but that's not really normal.
And just out of curiosity, and forgive my lack of expertise on the subject, but as I understand, the liver filters your blood, yes, with all of the different toxins that we're exposed to in the course of our lives, from, you know, microplastics to pesticides in our food, right, and so on, the liver is bearing the brunt of that, right, in terms of like really
it's shared, getting rid of toxins. It's shared by both the kidney and the liver. So those things that are water soluble are frequently filtered by the kidney. Those that are not water soluble have to be processed in a way and changed in a way. Mm-hmm. And that's where the liver comes in. It's a biological factory. It'll change substance A to substance B. And it's It's incredible the number of different substances it can change. And sometimes it changes substance A into something that's toxic to substance B, which that's why you have all of this drug-induced liver disease, because we don't all metabolize things the same. So every once in a while, somebody metabolizes something differently, and that metabolite is toxic. So I would think of the liver as mostly a biochemical exchange, not so much as a filter, like just the kidney. I think of the kidney more as like a filter. It's based on everything that's in water will wash out. The liver has to do something active to it to change the chemical nature of it. And right, it's the workhorse.
So, doctor, the word endoscopy and advanced endoscopy, can you give us the basics first on endoscopy and then what advanced endoscopy is and why it's important and valuable in your area?
Yeah. So endoscopy is the general term for when you put a scope within the body. Okay. What precedes the scopy in that tells you where you're putting it. A colonoscopy goes into the colon. Okay. We short form the one where we go through the mouth into the stomach. That's esophagogastroduodenoscopy. So that's a mouthful. Okay. So we just shorten that and call that endoscopy. But like if you put it in a joint, it's an arthroscopy. If you put it in the bladder, it's a cystoscopy. So, but endoscopy is the general term where you take a scope and pass it into the body. And then it allows you to do diagnostic things and procedural things that are therapeutic. And when we're talking about advanced endoscopy, well, this has evolved since I trained. So now it takes two extra years of training to do the things that I've picked up in practice in the last 30 years. The things that are considered advanced now would broadly be the ones that are done in the fourth year, the last year, which would be ERCP and endoscopic ultrasound. Ultrasound, like the ultrasound, you know, pregnant mother gets, or when you get jelly on the belly, is the same thing. You put the endoscope on the tip of the scope and you pass it down into the body. And because you're close to the organ, you get the best pictures. So it's the best picture of your pancreas. And it also allows you, since you're close to the organ, to do operational things, stick needles in it, biopsies in it. So this came out in the 90s. I was actually the first one in New Jersey to do it. I brought it to New Jersey. And it's evolved over the past years to be a mainstay in gastroenterology. And to learn that technique, you have to do an extra year of fellowship to learn those skills. The other part of advanced endoscopy is ERCP, another short version of a word you don't want to, endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography, right? Right. But it's a scope that allows you to go down and you stick a catheter into where the bile duct enters the bowel and you shoot dye backwards. And it gives you a picture of the biliary tree and a picture of the pancreas, okay, and allows you to work on those organs with the instruments that you have. And what's advanced about, the most advanced parts of it now, is you can cut the bottom of the bile duct and you can take a scope within a scope. You take the scope down to where the bile duct and you pass it up like a journey through the body, like back in the old movies where you can actually go inside the cholangium, go where no man's gone before, way up high, and then actually visualize things, take biopsies. So that's the frontier of endoscopy in the biliary sense. I was, first one to do that in New Jersey. And that's the cutting edge. And through that, I'm sorry, Vincent, but through that, you can biopsy things. You got lasers. You can blast stones up. It's actually a lot of fun things to do.
Well, doctor, I wanted to touch a little bit on pancreatic cancer screening. We have just about a minute and 30 seconds left. Maybe you can just do that and then let us know how folks can get in touch with you.
Yeah, well, the best way to do that cancer screening is really for people who already have a family history. I know everyone's afraid of it. It's a horrible diagnosis. And that's best done with 6 monthly intervals of alternating the endoscopic ultrasound we just talked about and an MRCP with some blood work. I'd be happy to talk to anybody that can find me here in Kingston. I finally made it to Broadway. 396 Broadway is the address of the office. And I'd be happy to see anybody and talk to them. It's been a fun transplant. I'm a transplanted city boy up here, so it's been fun.
Yeah, we all are, sort of. I think if you go to the WMC Health site, you'll find Dr. Kenny. Dr. Kenny, thank you so much for your work. It's so important. You and your colleagues are real assets to our community. We very much appreciate it.
All right, thank you for saying so. Thank you for having me, Vincent.
Of course. You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. Tune in next week for more great information that you can use to keep yourself, your family, and our community healthy and strong. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Healthy Ulster Radio Show from the Ulster County Department of Health. This program is a weekly community affairs presentation sponsored by the Emergency Department at Health Alliance Hospital in Kingston, a member of WMC Health. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us for another edition of the Healthy Ulster Radio Show next weekend.